Hello, beautiful people. How are you getting on? Welcome back to Depression Cure, the show where we discuss the latest tools, ancient practices, and cutting-edge research to help you take back control of your emotional well-being. My name is Hugh James. I'm a writer and podcaster from Ireland who's been in recovery from addiction and depression over the last 15 years. And today is all about the other guy on the other side of the mic. This is his big moment. It's his time to shine, and we are ready to rock and roll. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that we usually do the classic radio DJ thing where we each introduce ourselves. And I've asked Steve to give a slightly longer, more extended intro than he usually does, because as we kind of alluded to, this episode is all about him. So Steve, take it away, bro. Good to see you.
Hey, great to see you as well. Now, I got to give a disclaimer right at the outset, which is I have lived in the central U.S. Those longtime listeners know I'm very close to Kansas City. Great city, great American city. But in the Midwest, we have a cultural thing, which is you do not ever blow your own horn. It's an uncomfortable it's an uncomfortable thing. I've assimilated enough of the culture here that, yeah, I don't like to talk about myself, but if it's for a good cause today. So I'm just, in the interest of transparency, Hugh is the producer of this show. He says to me before the show, he's like, look, Steve, I want you to tell your story. And my reaction is, why? And he says, well, you know, it's really important for our audience to get a feel for the fact that you actually have been in this field. You are not only an experienced clinician, but an experienced researcher. You've done important work. You're regarded in the field. And that is all true. And it resonated with me immediately from a very pragmatic perspective on the following point. All of us, when we are struggling in any area and we feel like, okay, I have a problem, I have an issue, I want somebody to help me, here's the immediate problem. Who can I trust? Who has credibility? Who has the requisite experience where they can come to the table and say, look, I'm going to cut through all the crap, all the BS. I'm going to take you straight to the essential things that you need to know and understand. And you can actually trust that this is useful information that's not BS, that's not monetized, And so, yeah, Hugh, it's for a good cause. And so I'm happy to try to step outside my Midwestern American comfort zone.
As you've been speaking here, the soundtrack in my head has been like, da 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 da. Who are you going to call?
Oh my God. Somebody who's a little media savvy, if you want to make a little 20-second clip and send that to us, that'd be pretty epic.
Could be the new intro, who knows? New show, new intro, new music. Anyway, Steve.
Well, I am a big Bill Murray fan, so if you're talking about the original Ghostbusters, that's okay with me. Yeah, so what to say about myself? Well, first things first, I started graduate school 32 years ago at Duke University in North Carolina. It's regarded as one of our probably top 10.
It's a fancy school, yeah. It's even a fancy, I know that, and I'm Irish, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty fancy school. I was shocked to get in. I mean, genuinely.
It's a big basketball school, isn't it?
That was the biggest draw, I'm not going to lie. Oh, wait, second biggest draw behind the fact that they had an elite PhD program. And I was extremely lucky, very, very fortunate to get in and to work with a great mentor who is an expert in the realm of depression. And he had at that point, you know, probably 25 years of experience in that world. And the really bizarre thing is, it's really funny how life works this way sometimes. For any of you who ever want to consider applying to a PhD program that's very research focused, as mine was, even though it was a clinical program, so I got a lot of clinical training. Anyway, you're applying to a PhD program. The idea is you want to find a mentor who is your research guru, your Gandalf, as it were, who basically is asking all the questions that you are most passionate to explore. So there's got to be this great fit, right? And normally people who are aspiring to work with that person are going to have done all their background research. They're very savvy and they're like, oh, you're doing X, Y, and Z. I read your paper on this. I read your paper on that. I did none of that because I was not a psychology major. So I came to the game kind of late. And I had worked at Centers for Disease Control, CDC, which is right up the road from my undergrad uni. but I didn't have any of the guidance, the background. But in my application, my essay, I had said, I'm really, really interested in the intersection between problems of personality function. So ways in which our patterns of thoughts, behavior, feeling lead us into problems. So personality disorder and how people with personality disorders end up having other kinds of mental health problems, like clinical anxiety, like addiction, like depression, and so forth. Now, unbeknownst to me, the man that I ended up working with for the next 7 years of my career was a depression research superstar who was just starting to branch out into the realm of comorbidity, co-occurrence with personality disorder. So he was intrigued. He looked at my application. He's like, wow, this guy has a really weird background. He's a math guy. He's a computer programmer. He worked for a big bank. He worked at CDC. He's done epidemiology. He doesn't know anything about psychology, but like maybe there's something there. So he invites me as one of his finalists to interview. And we just hit it off instantly. And what I realized sitting there in the chair in real time in this interview is this guy is a world-class depression researcher. And I have never been clinically depressed, but three of my loved ones have. And so I know this illness up close and in personal, and I care about it in a way that kind of took my breath away while I'm sitting there in the seat and we're talking about the toll of depression and talking about the challenge of figuring out what's going on and how we can better serve people. And it was amazing. It was one of the most bizarre serendipity, kismet, providence, however you want to conceptualize the way the universe, sometimes the stars line up. And I was just at the right place at the right time. And that's how I became a depression researcher. I was not planning on that. But my third day at Duke University, my mentor, Ed, says, hey, I want to walk you up to the unit where you're going to be working this year. I said, the unit? And he's like, yeah, you know, the psych building is here. The building next door is Duke Medical Center, which is like one of the greatest, most prestigious medical centers, hospitals in the world. He's like, we're going to walk over to a psychiatric unit, one of like 10 there in the hospital. And you're going to be working for 10 hours a week on this locked psychiatric unit that is a specialty unit for people all over the country and some from other parts of the world that are struggling with debilitating depression and other mood disorder, bipolar and other disorders, many of whom have just made a suicide attempt. And for their own protection and safety, they're going to be on this locked unit. And like literally, welcome to grad school. You have no background in psychology. This is day three. You're going to be conducting clinical assessment, diagnostic interviews, and other clinical work with these individuals. Wow. I believe in the business, this is known as baptism by fire. Thrown into the deep end of the pool.
My goodness.
But it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life to get this opportunity to be right there in the trenches from day one, with people who were desperate, who were suffering, who appreciated just the empathic connection, because I had been up close and intimate with three of my loved ones in their struggles with depression. I had a very strong intuitive understanding of what was happening, of how to be present, how not to. I mean, I still had plenty to learn, but it was just one of those really, really watershed moments in my life where it was like a flashbulb, like an epiphany, like, okay, I'm going to tackle this problem of clinical depression. And at the time, you have to, you know, go all the way back to 1990. It was at the heyday of optimism over the quote, chemical imbalance model of depression. And the idea that, oh, we have these powerful, what were alleged to be powerful new drugs, Prozac, what we called it in the, I think you call it Prozac also there.
Well, we call it the drug name, whatever that is.
Oh,
yes, it's heavily prescribed.
If you're keeping score at home, we call it fluoxetine
as the
generic branded in the US. All Americans or Canadians as well, will have heard of Prozac. And what I was seeing up close was not matching the hype right away. I was like, okay, yeah, you know, for some patients, it can be helpful, but it's not a miracle drug by any stretch. And, you know, so that was the first thing. The second thing, though, was it was really clear to me from the outset that depression contained extraordinary mystery, and really a couple of mysteries. One was, why are rates of clinical depression going up so much? Because it was really, really clear, even in 1990, that rates of depression were already starting to skyrocket. Number two, why are they skyrocketing even while we're throwing all these medications and other forms of therapy at it? Number three, what is really driving depression? And I mean, at a causal, immediate causal level, I was kind of overwhelmed to learn early in my grad school training that roughly one out of every five research papers in the realm of psychiatry, clinical psychology, mental health, one out of five are about depression. So already 32 years ago, there were tens of thousands of published papers on depression. And nobody really had a great synthesis of putting it all together. Like, how does, like, there are genetic things, there are molecular things, there are neurotransmitter things, there are hormonal things, there are brain circuitry things, there are cognitive mental things. There's ways that we have negative distorted thoughts and ways that we ruminate, and it affects our behavior and our social. And nobody had really put it all together. And nobody knew how to get people who are depressed, how to get them in full recovery and keep them in full recovery in a consistent sort of way. So our best treatments, even if we thought we're giving world-class care, most people were not getting 100% better. And even if they were, they weren't staying 100% better. Well, you can fast forward to 2022 while we're recording this. And that is still true, by the way. Most depressed patients who get treatment as usual, even, you know, the best treatment we have, they're not getting well and staying well. And, you know, that's because our treatment as usual is not getting the job done. And so I became really passionately engaged in this. You know, I'm a puzzle solver. I'm a problem solver. And I thought, okay, this is an intellectual puzzle that is big enough to throw myself into, because the stakes are really high, because we're talking about tens of millions of lives. We're talking about 1 million people every year that take their own life through suicide, most of them depression-linked suicide. We're talking about, you know, such suffering and debilitation. Like, well, that's a worthy goal to try to, you know, make some contribution to this area. Now, I was early in my career, I think, maybe appropriately humble enough to think like, oh, I'll, you know, science usually progresses by people who feel like, oh, well, I'll add another little brick or two to edifice, you know, these hard won, these bricks, by the way, I said little, but they're these really cherished, hard won facts that are the results, the fruits of years and years and years of very, very intense labor. And if you're lucky, you know, if you're lucky and if you're good and you have to be both, then you can pluck a couple of these hard won truths and you can add it to the wall. And over time, there's this cumulative character. That was my goal. And my early focus was, you know, a lot of my early training, well, two kinds of training. One, as a therapist, was in the most heavily researched form of psychotherapy for depression. We call it CBT. And a lot of listeners will have heard of CBT. It stands for cognitive behavior therapy. So let's focus on the negative thinking that typically characterizes depression and the shutdown of behavior. So let's get people more, you know, more engaged, more active. And so that's the therapy approach. And I got a lot of training in it, and I did a lot of research in it. And I quickly became somewhat dissatisfied with it. Not that it can't be helpful, but it certainly can, but I was just seeing like it's not as powerful as we need it to be. Oh, and there's a hell of a lot more going on with depression than just negative thinking. And I became obsessed with understanding everything at every level, which includes, of course, the biological level, the genetic level, the neurotransmitter level, the hormonal level, you know, what's happening in the brain, what's happening in the body. And I became absolutely convinced that if we're ever going to solve this puzzle, if I was ever going to make a contribution, I needed to really become a clinical neuroscientist as well as just a cognitive therapist. And so I got neuroscience training, and my first, I would say, 7-8 years of my research career were primarily publishing really esoteric papers about. I got a. I don't know if I ever told you this, Hugh, but I got a big research grant from our national NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health. It was $700,000 to work with a neuroimaging colleague of mine to look at. Get this. Are you ready for this? I hope you're sitting down. The hemispheric lateralization of verbal and nonverbal information processing biases in depression. So in other words, while we're depressed, we tend to see the world in a much more negative way. And it has all kinds of really profound implications, this negativistic bias in attention, interpretation, and perception, and so forth. And so we designed some, I thought, kind of clever experiments to look at, like, well, what about, like, you know, sentence processing? You look at brainwave patterns. If you send information to the right hemisphere versus the left, we were sending self-referential sentences like, I am a loser, and looking at the brainwave. And you can actually see when you read a or hear a word that you were not expecting in a sentence, if it's surprising, if it doesn't fit, you get a characteristic brainwave pattern. You can see it on an EEG, electroencephalogram. If you're keeping score at home, folks, it's one of the components we looked at was called the N400, negative amplitude waveform, 400, 4/10 of a second, 400 milliseconds after you get the word. So we were doing all this cool esoteric stuff, trying to put our little brick in the wall. And, you know, I think we did. But like literally I'd publish a paper and there were 50 people in the world who could understand it and really jazzed about, like, oh, this is so cool about hemispheric lateralization. I was happy doing it. But, you know, a weird thing happened. Another turn of the universe, I think, which is I got tenure. Those of you who don't know that basically, you know, my university, after I'd been there for 5 years, they said, okay, we think you're worthy. You've done enough. You're productive enough. Your teaching is good. Your research, your service. We're going to give you tenure, which means unless you really screw up, you could just do whatever the hell you want. And you're going to be protected by academic freedom. And then I read an account by an anthropologist named Edward Schieffelin of his sojourn with a modern day Aboriginal group, largely hunter-gatherer. They live a lot like our ancestors did for hundreds of thousands of years. They're called the Kaluli, K-A-L-U-L-I, people of Papua New Guinea, the highlands. And so Schieffelin was really interested in mental health and psychiatric illness among the Kaluli because they live very hard lives. They have high rates of parasitic infection. They have high rates of infant mortality. They have high rates of intertribal violence and death due to warfare. So he suspected that they would probably have high rates of mental illness because we know all of these things can be triggers for Americans, for Brits, for Irishmen and women, for Europeans. If you have health challenges, your rate of risk of depression goes up. If you are violently assaulted, your risk of depression goes up. If you lose a child, your risk of depression goes up, right? All these things are depressogenic, as we say in the business. And yet what Schieffelin saw among this Kaluli people is they never get depressed. And what I mean is they don't get shut down by clinical depression. Now they get sad. They grieve if they lose a loved one. They mourn, they grieve, but they're not clinically depressed. They're not shut down. They're not disabled by that. They allow themselves to feel very sad, but that's not what we mean when we talk about clinical depression. And I was blown away because, I mean, he spent 10 years with 2,000 members of the Kaluli people, and he's like, yeah, I saw kind of one marginal case. And I'm like, can I cuss on this pod? I was going to say I'm not a big profanity advocate, but sometimes I'm just going to say it. We can bleep it out if you want. No, you know what? I'll bleep myself. Holy crap. You can feel it stronger.
I love to see the tension there. That was so hilarious. That was like a whole like opera in just a space of 15 seconds.
Yeah. Somebody could do a little TikTok of that and just be like, watch a guy try to talk himself into and then out of dropping an S bomb or an F bomb or something. Anyway, I did not let the record reflect. I did not. I said, holy crap, look at this. What are the Kaluli doing that we're not doing? Oh, better yet, what are they doing? That's probably whatever they're doing. It matches what our ancestors were doing. And then the light bulb really went off because it was like, wait a minute. Clinical depression is so highly prevalent, so epidemic in the modern world if our ancestors had been shut down by depression at that rate, they never would have made it. We would have gone extinct as a species. There would have been, at the very least, incredibly strong selection pressure for the brain to make its own natural antidepressant, the way the brain makes its own natural opiate.
Yeah, anyone who is prone to depression just wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, so like the brain can, I think probably most listeners know this, the brain makes its own opiates. We call them endorphins and enkephalins. Well, the brain also makes its own cannabis, believe it or not, endocannabinoids. Why doesn't the brain make its own antidepressant? That's interesting, right? It should if our ancestors had been as vulnerable as we are. Turns out the people that live like our ancestors, the Kaluli, they don't need it. Why don't we make our own antidepressant? Well, because we didn't need it through history. Yeah. Why didn't we need it? Well, because there are things that we're doing now that are psychologically toxic. Again, I'll use the fancy word, depressogenic. They cause depression. But maybe more importantly, there are things that our ancestors did that protected them. There are things the Kaluli do that are protecting them. And the really brilliant piece of that is there are things that we can do.
Yeah.
We can reclaim these healing habits. And so.
So good.
Thank you. So I had this epiphany and I had just gotten tenure. And I'm like, you know.
There's a rabbit hole to go down.
I'm a clinical neuroscientist. I have this big grant from NIMH to do neuroscience, to do real basic lab science, bench science. I'm going to pivot really hard and reinvent my career as a depression treatment researcher, but not just any depression treatment researcher. I think I've stumbled onto something so important that I want to develop radically new treatment approach to depression premised on the idea of this gene environment mismatch, premised on the idea that we were never designed for this, that there are features of modern life that are really psychologically toxic, and that we already have mountains of research to support the idea that we can learn from the Kaluli and have the best of both worlds. Because I'm not interested in going back to the Stone Age. I'm not interested in getting rid of electricity and plumbing and my laptop. And, you know, let's be honest, I'm kind of fond of my phone and my Spotify, kind of fond of the occasional mocha latte, you know. So I want to have it all. And I want you, dear listener, to have it all. I want us to be able to reclaim the healing habits of the past and weave them into the fabric of day-to-day life.
So good.
In the present. Thank you.
I love that. So that was really the light bulb was what you then, I guess, developed into your TED talk with, you know, multi-million views. We've published it on this channel as well. If anyone's interested, you can scroll back and listen to it. This idea that depression is a disease of civilization. And from what I know of you, I know that that's where you've spent the bulk of your career since that moment, really exploring and digging into. What I'd love to know is, you know, I love that point where you said, you know, I was publishing research papers that like 50 people in the world understood. How does someone like you then go about getting a book contract that then goes on to reach like hundreds of thousands of lay people like me who, you know, aren't academic in the slightest, aren't clinical researchers, aren't neuroscientists? How does that happen? And I guess, what happened?
Yeah, that's a really deep question. And you could probably see the wheels spinning. I mean, there are a lot of different ways I could come at it. So I think maybe the shortest way, maybe the most direct way is to say that while I was this geeky bench scientist, lab scientist doing all this esoteric work, I also was lucky enough to be able to be in the classroom with my graduate students and undergraduate, but particularly I always treasure the time spent with undergraduates who provide such an extraordinary audience and community for exploring ideas and for staying grounded and for staying honest. And so one of the things, by the way, this is a basic survival skill for any professor, any instructor, any teacher really, is you've got to learn how to get really good at communicating in a way that, you know, an average freshman can not only understand, but find interesting and find compelling, which means leaning into a lot of things, Hugh, that you do very effortlessly and naturally, like learning how to tell a good story, learning how to give really vivid examples that just, you know, make everything pop, learning how to translate abstract ideas into, you know, things that are much, much more intuitive. I'm a big believer in this idea that everything that happens to us, if we're willing to stay open, willing to learn from even the dead ends in our lives, willing to learn from even the things, maybe even in our past that we don't fully hold on to, and we're like, there were some things about that that were kind of wonky. Like as a kid, I would, especially as a teenager, I would find myself kind of, dragged is too strong a word. I'd find myself, I grew up in a fairly religiously devout household. And I listened to a lot of messages, a lot of sermons that, like, if you put me in one of these, you know, camp meetings or revival meetings or whatever today, I would just be like, where's the exit? I cannot get out of here fast enough. Like, what the hell is even happening right now? But one thing I think it occurred to me is that growing up in that sort of milieu gave me an extraordinary appreciation for how to take rather abstract ideas, philosophical, theological, whatever ideas, and help them land with real impact and emotional heft for an audience. So when I got in the classroom, what I realized, I would have students sometimes that would be like, Dr. Lardy, don't take this the wrong way, but you kind of like, you've got this style sometimes that's a little bit like a good preacher or a good, whatever.
Yeah.
At first, I didn't know how to take it, but they meant it as a compliment. They were like, you've got these chops that are, you know, because of the emotional impact and the whatever. So I think what happened is when I caught fire with this idea of depression is a disease of civilization, and I am now in possession of information that is life-changing. And I saw it, you know, I didn't start off preaching the gospel of therapeutic lifestyle change before I saw it in action. So the first thing I did is I started meeting with my research group saying, what would it look like to design a treatment built around the things that our ancestors did that we don't do anymore, like physical activity and spending time outdoors and getting healthy sleep and learning how to stay connected and part of community and getting anti-inflammatory fats back into our diet and, you know, all these things. So we developed a treatment program and we started piloting it and we started running groups, therapy groups, and we saw people's lives change. And I did the same thing with some of my own individual therapy patients because I had a very small private practice. And I was like, all right, I'm seeing miraculous kinds of, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, extraordinary, extraordinary recoveries in people sometimes who had battled for decades and had been on every med and had been on every, you know, been through every type of talk therapy that was available, and nothing had gotten them where they needed to be. And now they were adopting this lifestyle-based approach and it was life-changing. And I was like, all right, so now it's time to get the word out. Well, how did I get the book contract? Again, I guess I'm leaning in today to the idea that the universe sometimes, when it wants something to happen, it's going to happen. I have a friend who's an astonishingly accomplished writer, and she's sold over 4 million copies of her books. That's big time, really, really big time. And I asked her for some advice once I started working on an outline, a framework for my book, because I wanted to get the word out there. She said, why don't you put together a pitch, you know, a book proposal and the first chapter. And she's like, send it to me. I'll give you some feedback. I was like, really? That'd be awesome. So I sent it to her. Well, she then sends it to her agent, unbeknownst to me. Her agent is the same agent that used to represent Brené Brown, who's a big, big, big name in, for those of you who don't know, that's a really, really big name in the space. And her agent contacted me and said, I would like to represent you. I think you're onto something.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's like you can't script this stuff. Sometimes things just happen, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to be so willing to walk through that door when it opens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like I've shared in other episodes, I'll not go into the big violin story in this bit, but you know, it was your book that was like one of the major turning points in my own journey with depression, which is ultimately why we're doing this podcast today. And you know, I love how you take the esoteric and the nitty gritty science and you communicate it in such a way that's not only easy to understand, but actually compelling enough to, you know, at least make me and thousands of other people around the world implement those six steps into their lifestyle to help them overcome depression. You know, and the tagline is so good. You obviously put a lot of thought into it, or your publisher did, you know, the six steps to overcome depression without the use of drugs. And I now am a disciple of the gospel of the therapeutic lifestyle. And everywhere I go, anyone who will listen, whether it's a big crowd or whether it's someone on the bus, I'm always saying to them, you know, we're not against medication. My personal opinion is that medication is just really trying to treat a symptom. And not a lot of people are asking, what is causing this to begin with? Mm-hmm. And your work, you know, depression is a disease of civilization and the six steps is the most compelling thing that I found to give us a reason why. And then not only the why, but okay, now we know this, what will we do because of that?
Exactly. So yeah.
That's one big setup just to kind of bring us into our final question here, which is, Dr. Professor Mr. Alardi. Stevie boy.
Oh, Stevie boy. Yeah, that's good.
Why are you doing this podcast? You know, you have a lot on your plate. You're a professor. You do random crazy stuff with the MBA. You've got a family, you know, your father. You've built this incredible life for yourself and you deserve every single bit of it. Why add this to your plate, especially as you're, you know, moving into the twilight years of your tenured professorhood? I'm sure like you're starting, like there's, the world is your oyster. Why this?
That's a great question. It felt to me like, well, first of all, I follow where my interests take me. And I follow where the opportunities open up. And I got to know this talented young writer and podcaster producer from Ireland. And I joined him on his podcast for a guest episode. And we had extraordinary chemistry on camera, on mic chemistry. And I thought, you know, I think there's something here. Now, obviously, it's a long shot. And, you know, there's no guarantee that for this to be sustainable, we're going to need a lot more patrons for the long haul. We have a very generous donation from a couple people that's allowing us to do this for about a year. Whether it persists beyond that, who knows? But it's worthwhile. I mean, for one thing, Hugh, I'm a big believer in just being all in the moment. You know, carpe diem, seize the moment, seize the day. And the journey is just as important as the destination. This process is a joyful part of my life right now. And the fact that there are people out there who find it valuable is really wonderful. My hope is that, you know, and I hope this doesn't sound immodest, but my strong intuition is, based on everything I've experienced, that there are literally thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people out there who would really find this content valuable and really helpful if they knew about it, if they could find it. The challenge, of course, is breaking through a very, very, very cluttered space because there are probably millions of podcasts out there now. So it's a long shot. We knew that going in, but it's fun. It's joyful. And I feel like it's got a real potential to extend the message, to reach people where they are. And, you know, podcast is the new radio. And in a lot of ways, podcasting is also the new publishing, in the sense that book reading, especially among people under 30 or even maybe people under 40, they're not reading as much as they used to. So they're getting their content this way. I think it's worth doing. When I did a couple of TEDx talks, I knew going in, like, you know, most of them don't really find their audience because there are gazillions of TEDx talks now. Somehow mine did. I can't explain it, but they did. when I published my book, my publisher told me the median book sales for a published book for a real publisher is 3,000 copies. If your book, she said, if your book does 10,000, you should be ecstatic.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I'm not special. You know, I mean, we'll see. And going into the podcast, I had a similar kind of feeling, like, you know, it is genuinely a long shot. I don't think I'm special. I do think you're special, but even so, it's a bit of a long shot, but I've been really pleasantly surprised by the number of long shots in my life that have somehow panned out. So I remain hopeful about this one as well.
I love it. Steve, thank you. I mean, I was going to say thank you as always, but I think thank you especially for today, for sharing in detail like a lot of your story, because even for me, like I've learned actually things about you that I didn't know, which I'm surprised, because I just kind of feel like, oh yeah, like I know Steve, like I know what he's about. And it's really cool to kind of see bits of the puzzle that maybe I fully pulled together.
Can I ask what's one thing that you learned that you like was genuinely new?
Well, I'm really surprised that your relationship with Ed, I think that's really interesting. And yeah. I'd love to kind of like talk to you more about that off mic as well. Cause yeah, I feel like in some ways, like you're a bit of an Ed for me. And I would love to kind of see like just the role reversal now of how like you're in a stage of your life where you've become an Ed for not just me, but for lots of other people. And I'm curious, like, what was your experience of being in my position, you know, as the mentee? And so I'd love to unpack some of that. I think that would be super cool. And yeah, there's a whole bunch more, but it was Ed in particular that was interesting.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I'd love to talk about that. And yeah, you know, I mean, there is this weird sort of, I say weird, I mean, magical sort of circle of life that when everything is working well, as we develop and progress, we have a chance to emulate the people that have meant the most to us, right? And maybe, and I have to be really careful how I say this, but I think maybe we see it the most as parents, where we have a chance to take the things that we saw our parents do that we valued that really worked and pay them the compliment of integrating that. But then also to try to step up, you know, to raise the bar and to say, okay,
dude, stand on the shoulders of giants. That's what it's all about.
There are things that my parents did that I have vivid memories of being like 7, 8 years old and saying, I will never do that to my kids.
Yeah.
And true story, some of them I have done. I'm like, oh, actually, you know, but some of them I feel like I've actually, you know, been able to improve on and say, you know, let's do it even better this time. So that's super fun.
I love that, man. Cool. Well, genuinely, thank you so much for today. Like, I know I found it interesting. I know it will set like a really useful context for people who already have joined us on this kind of 30 episode journey. And as we embark on this new brand, new me, new podcast, niching down into depression, renamed it the title of your book, Depression Cure. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing where this next kind of chapter of the journey takes us. So yeah, thank you for being
our
in-house Gandalf.
I look forward to speaking
to you next time.
this has been amazing. Thank you. I do just want to put a little marker for our listeners. This is for at least a season, for a time. We're not saying this podcast is going to be all depression all the time. We both, Hugh and I, have really broad interests and are passionate about well-being across the board, not just for those who struggle with depression. So I want to make sure if you're part of our audience and depression hasn't been the main focus of your mental health, I'd encourage you to stick around, because we're going to circle back to so many other areas. And you can also shoot us an email, shoot us a voicemail, whatever, and let us know what your particular concerns are. Oh, one last thing. If you would be so good, go review us, rate us and review us on whatever platform.
Dude, he's a pro podcaster now. this is not the Steve I started podcasting with. Look at this.
You know, you've created a monster.
You have a lot of titles. You've got doctor, you've got professor. Like, I can't wait for the day. Like, I'm going to have a ceremony. Like, I don't know. It's going to look really, really weird, but I'm going to bestow the title producer on you at some point.
And dude.
You're going to ascend into, like, media greatness.
We'll call it the apotheosis. It's going to be legendary. Rate and review us. 5 star. No. however many stars you think we're worthy of.
Five stars and none at all. That's what they say.
Go big or go. No. What it does, just in case you don't know, which you probably don't. If you take the time to give a rating and a review of a podcast, it helps other people find us and makes it easier for it to propagate up if somebody's searching for, you know, something about depression or mental health. So that would be
Cool. I'll be honest. I put it out there. Here's my goal for this podcast. Like, literally my dream. My dream is that people who are struggling and at a rock bottom moment in their life, to the point where they're, like I was, putting depression into Spotify, that they will be connected with content that will actually be meaningful and allow them to take a positive step forward on that journey. That's what I would love. And reviews, actually,
brilliant.
You know, SEO, search engine optimization, all these fancy words.
Oh,
reviews,
dude.
Help you rise up to the top of the pile. And so, yeah, we would love to be that for people who are struggling. And I genuinely, I wholeheartedly believe in Steve's research, and I'm really excited to disseminate it in this new format, to use some kind of random language.
I love it. That brilliant.
This new generation, this new kind of way of consuming media and content, I'm excited to get the Depression Cure onto the airwaves. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, my friend. Thank you all for listening, for joining us. If you can't see Hugh, unless you're joining us on the video feed, he's given the peace sign. He's tapping into his inner flower child. I think he is somewhere. I'm not sure I believe in past lives. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. But if I did, this dude was there at Woodstock. I'm just saying. Until next time, everyone, be well.
See you guys. Thanks a bunch.
Ciao.